Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the second week in October. This week, we are very happy to go on explores looking for insects and insect galls at H.J. Carroll Park with our guide, entomologist Richard Lewis. Welcome, Richard. We're very happy to have you back out in the field with us again.
Thank you for being here with me, and it's a real pleasure of mine to have an opportunity to share some of these things with you.
Well, we are so happy to have you, and we're also joined by our fellow nature lover and recorder, Meg Amos, who might chime in with some insect questions of her own. But first, let's hear the mystery sound of the week, one that Richard suggested himself. Notice that there are two very different sounds, but they are closely related. We'll play them again at the end of the program, and Richard will tell us more about them. The idea for this show came to me when I opened up my email a few weeks ago to find the Washington Native Plant Society's newsletter for late summer and fall, and found their very interesting article announcing that it's gall season. They start by saying, summer and fall are plant gall hunting season. Once you start looking for galls, you'll see them everywhere. What? You do? Well, I want to look for galls, and I figured that our curious radio audience would too. So I called up our entomologist friend Richard Lewis to ask him if he would take us out, looking for both galls and the most common insects of our fall season. And he happily agreed. He then went on a foray looking for a good local place to find galls, and found a nice assortment of them at H.J. Carroll Park in Chimicum, which is part of the fine Jefferson County Parks and Recreation System. So that is where we are meeting today for our field trip. You might hear in the background, it's also a place that kids play sport, and we're out on just the most gorgeous evening, late afternoon. We feel really lucky to be here. And I was especially glad to be meeting here to see the lovely Kulkahan native plant demonstration gardens again. These gardens have been a labor of love for local landscaper and native plant enthusiast Linda Landkammer, along with several dedicated volunteers since the late 1980s. The area used to be an old commercial gravel pit, and over the decades has gradually been transformed to represent several ecosystems or plant communities of the Pacific Northwest. If you haven't ever been out here before, it's well worth a visit. And it's a great place to not only view native plant communities, but to also view the insect pollinators attracted to them. So, Richard, perhaps we should start with asking you to define what a gall is.
Well, a gall is a plant growth or deformity, and it's generally caused by an insect, either through egg-laying or feeding behaviors. And there's a number of different types of insects that will cause gall formation, and it can occur anywhere on a plant, from the roots up to the leaves. There are several other organisms, bacteria, fungi, nematodes, that also cause galls. But the ones we'll be looking at today, and the most common ones that you see if you're out looking around, are formed by insects and mites.
The galls are very specific to the plant species, right? I mean, you can identify what insect it is oftentimes if you can identify the plant species.
That's correct. Galls have been studied for a long time, but surprisingly we know very little about them. There's over 2,000 different types of galls, but not that many have been identified. But the ones that we do know, you can actually identify the species of insect by the formation of the gall. So every specific insect feeds on or lays an egg on a specific species of plant. And that interaction creates a deformity on the plant, causing the gall. And it's specific in shape and size and color. So by finding the gall and looking at the gall's form and the type of plant that it's on, you can determine the insect that caused that gall even without finding or seeing the insect itself.
It's really amazing, and some of them are so cool. I mean, they look like alien life forms. Also, I was doing a bit of reading. You can tell the species of insect by where on the leaf they'll deposit, or where the gall forms, right? Whether it's like on the top of the leaf or underneath the leaf or on the stem, or which plant part it is, even down to the surface of the leaf, it'll be different for different species of insect, right?
Yeah, that's correct. There's a number of different gall-forming insects on different plants. In fact, something like an oak has one of the most extensive lists of gall-forming insects, where there's estimates between 200 and 500 different types of gall-forming insects on oaks. Other plants, like a willow, has about 24, 25. Some only have one or two specific insects that work on them. But those insects do have specialized areas and locations within the plant itself that they will form a gall. So that is a key factor in determining the type of insect, or the gall former, is the location and placement of the gall itself.
Something else in my reading that I'd always thought that galls harm the plant, but they were saying that they usually don't. It provides no benefit to the plant, but it usually is not something that's detrimental to their health, right?
That's correct. Insect and mite galls generally pose no harm. Sometimes they can be kind of unsightly. People find them, and especially if they're in large numbers, they can be concerning to people that aren't aware of what they are and what's going on. Typically, a heavy season of gall formation on an individual plant is generally followed up by a very light load the subsequent years, so that they decrease rapidly after a heavy gall-forming season. And there's very little that causes any kind of damage. They are a bit of a nutrient sink. If you get really high numbers, there's been some reports where it's been a bit of a strain on the plant, in large numbers of galls. But for the most part, we don't recommend any kind of treatment or activity towards trying to remove or get rid of the galls. If you have a problem seeing them or don't like them there, you can prune them out, but we don't recommend kind of trying to do anything to eradicate them.
Good. Well, before we go on a quest for galls, I also want to be sure to ask about wasp biology, since one of the most noticeable insects around right now are yellow jackets. And even though I don't actively like yellow jackets, I have a great deal of respect for them and feel that they are actively maligned. I mean, they're amazing scavengers and decomposers, right?
They are scavengers. They're actually predators for a lot of pest insects. Much like bees collect pollen from flowers and use that to rear their young, wasps go out and collect protein, generally other insects, caterpillars, and tend to be a lot of pest species, and bring them back to feed their young. Of course, with the ability to sting, it can be an issue with people if they're in around your home, or if you have small children that might be close to areas where they're interacting with wasp nests. But generally, considering them out in the field, we look at them as a beneficial insect, and they help kind of maintain or knock down some of the pest populations that are more problematic than the wasps.
Uh-huh. So would you review their life history? I mean, right now they're pretty much at their peak, right? People are seeing these giant paper wasp nests or yellow jacket nests, and they're going, oh no, they're going to be, you know, millions. I need to get rid of these now. But they are all going to die soon. The queen is the only one that survives the winter, right?
Yeah, that's true. As the leaves fall and things open up, people start to notice nests in places they may not have even realized that they were there all summer. So in the springtime, the mated queen emerges, and she'll go out and start making a few cells and fill those cells with eggs. And while the eggs are maturing, she'll go out and collect some food.
Excuse me, but those cells can be placed underground or, you know, under your porch, or they can be both aerial and underground, right?
That's correct. They tend to be cavity nesting, so they look for holes in a tree, or they'll make a hole in the ground that was an old mouse nest or some kind of cavity down in the ground where they'll nest in there. If they can't find a place like that that's more protected, they will go up under the eaves. That's a very common place, especially if you have kind of an overhanging eave. It's a little more of a three-sided wall in there, and they'll start their nest in a location like that. Once the queen feeds and hatches out and rears the first population of wasps, then she stays in the nest and continues laying eggs and growing the population. And the new batch of workers does all the other jobs as far as foraging for food for the new developing wasps or any of the maintenance on the nest. They use bits of wood that they chew up with their saliva, forming it into a pulp, which is what they use for making the papery type material.
That paper is so beautiful. I mean, it's just swirls of different shades of grays and browns and tans, and it's really quite lovely.
It is an amazing material, and it does feel a lot like paper if you touch it. They have long kind of strands around the outside forming the outer shell, and then inside they have actual cells, a lot like in a beehive, where they rear the individual larvae from the queen laying the eggs and then the foragers and the workers going out and taking care of them. So the wasp nest is a group of social insects. It's one single queen that controls the population, and then a whole bunch of workers that do all the work for the nest to supply food and take care of things for all the developing larvae. So during the summer, the population continues to build up, and this time of year right now, we're really at a peak population level. As we get into cooler weather and the nights get cold, the population starts declining, and after the first freeze, it's almost completely gone, and during the winter, any surviving wasps in the nest will die out. The only wasps that live are the mated overwintering queens. So late in the fall, the nest will produce queens and males. And the queens will fly around on mating flights and mate with the males. Shortly after they mate, all the males will die off. And the new queens will find a protected area under some bark or in a crack or crevice in the house or somewhere in the duff.
People have firewood piles. A lot of times when they're bringing firewood in, you have to be really careful because there'll be a really fat wasp there, and that's an overwintering queen, right, that's squirreled away in your wood pile.
Correct. They'll find a hidden area like that where they're safe for the winter, and they go into kind of a state of hibernation or diapause for the winter, and then the next spring, those queens will start a new colony somewhere else. They do not reuse the old hive from the previous year.
Thank you for clarifying that, because it's confusing. At this time of year, the wasps are particularly aggressive, so people are like, oh, we have to get rid of those, and there are just thousands of insects. And so they spray them, and then, you know, it's so unnecessary. If we can just learn to avoid where those insects are, they're going to be dying off, and that nest is all going to be empty if we can just hang on for a few weeks. And there's a really great book called Common Sense Pest Control, put out by the Taunton Press, and it has some really great information on yellow jackets and other creatures that humans consider pests. And it gives you ideas on how to live with them or minimize the negative effects that they can have on our lives so that we don't have to poison them and poison the whole ecosystem in the meantime.
Yeah. One of the big problems with the wasps this time of year is that the population is peaking, and the adult wasps need a food source or an energy source to keep moving around and fly and do the things that they do. So they feed the developing larvae a protein source, which they collect using other insects and things, but they have carbohydrates that they need for themselves. So as the season wears on and nectar sources dry out, the wasps are looking for other places to find a sugary source, some kind of energy.
Soda. Yeah.
So that's where the human interaction really starts increasing.
Yeah.
And that's why they It's not that there's so many more around this time of year, but they're much more aggressively kind of interacting with humans, getting into the garbage or into your picnics and things where they become more of a nuisance. But the hive itself is not something that is going to be a problem or that needs to be taken care of or treated in any way. They'll just kind of go away on their own if you leave them alone.
Yeah, great. Insects are just amazing, and we don't pay nearly enough attention to them.
I just spent a few minutes walking along a little bit of the trail here at the park. There are a number of galls that can be seen right from the trail, and if we want to take a quick walk, it'd be great to go take a look at a few of the ones that we have marked.
Yeah, let's do that. So now we're on a little walk, and Richard is describing how to look for galls, just to look for deformities, right?
Yeah, so the galls can form anywhere on the plant. So I generally kind of just take an overall view, and you look at the different leaves and the different petioles and stems coming down off of them and see if you can just notice any deformities. This time of year, there's a tremendous amount of leaf deformity or leaf activity, things that have been chewed on or broken or burnt out. And these are leaves that have been rolled up because of a gall aphid causing the leaf roll. And here we open the leaf up and you see a ladybug come crawling out. The ladybug is actually a predator of the aphids.
And, you know, if you don't know what's going on, you would never know that. I mean, you'd think that the ladybug created that, but it was the aphid that created the gall, and then the ladybug came in to eat the aphids.
So you make a great point there in that we call it the gall community. A lot of times the former of the gall is not an insect that you see, and there's actually a number of other insects that come into the galls because of the protection and the food source, as well as predators and parasites that are attacking the gall-forming insects. So a lot of times if you collect galls and try and rear them out to see what insects are coming out of them, it may not actually be the forming insect that caused the gall that you end up collecting. It could be a type of a parasite that was attacking the insect, or it could be a predator, or it could just be kind of another insect that came in for some type of shelter or food that it was trying to take advantage of.
And this is high bush cranberry. It still has some of the beautiful berries on it. This is part of the demonstration garden, though, as Richard was commenting, he said that there isn't as much gall activity as you'd think in the native plant garden because it's so well tended that the galls have been
pruned out.
Yeah.
So this is a scowler's willow, and a willow is another one of those trees that kind of has a large host of insects all over it. And if you look at the stems coming off of here, you'll see literally thousands of aphids. So these are actually a different type of aphid than the ones that were forming the galls on the other plant.
And you know, it's amazing because they camouflage so well with the stem that you can't see them. I wouldn't have noticed those if you hadn't have pointed them out.
I actually hadn't noticed them until I was looking for the galls, and then I saw some kind of movement. The aphid is a really interesting insect. It has a piercing, sucking mouth part, kind of like a needle, and it sticks it into the plant and sucks out the juices. So the gall-forming aphids do the same thing where they feed on the leaf, and the formation of the gall is kind of this amazing interaction between plant and chemistry and insect. Humans have studied galls for a long time, but we've never actually been able to induce a gall formation without the gall-forming insect. We haven't been able to duplicate what's going on there. So the aphid excretes a saliva or some type of chemical when it's feeding on the plant. And that chemical causes the plant cells to either grow more rapidly or divide more rapidly or grow bigger or sometimes both. And that's how it forms the gall. So it's almost like a tumor. The aphids that we see on this plant are not gall-forming aphids. These are just aphids on the stem of the plant, which are feeding on the sap as it goes through the stem. But they're not inducing galls on this particular plant. But right nearby here, we see at the base of this petiole, these very large red kind of balls at the base of it. And this is from a sawfly. This is a type of primitive wasp. A sawfly is a wasp insect that's kind of older. They don't have a constricted waist like most wasps do. But this is a sawfly willow gall. And you can see real clearly how they kind of stand out. It's a red color and a really kind of large lump at the base of these leaves. And that's a very distinctive gall. If you look up scowler willow and galls, these kind of pop up, and they're really quite easy to identify as the sawfly that's caused that gall.
Since I'm not that familiar with galls, I always saw those and thought it was like some fungus, a disease. So I'm really glad to know.
Yeah, it doesn't cause any harm to the plant. And again, it creates kind of this little community. There's other types of vertebrates and mammals, things like squirrels and birds and other things that are predators of galls. And they also create these shelters that other insects can take advantage of. So there's all kinds of different things that go on around the gall other than just the gall formation itself.
So, Richard, you were saying that there's a really interesting history about galls.
Yeah, there's some really incredible background that I think people might be interested in. Galls have been having this interaction with plants for a long time. We've found fossil galls over 200 million years old.
Wow.
So it's really been this kind of mutual development over a really long time that's created such a diverse number of gall species of insect and gall formations on different kinds of plants. We've had information or proof that back in the early days, they've been used both as a food source and as medicine. A lot of early Native Americans ground them up and used them for different things as medicines. One of the most well-used or long-term uses of galls is that they have a specific gall that grows on oak trees, has a really high level of tannic acid, and it's been used to make permanent ink. And
wow.
Years ago, it was the only way that people could use to have a permanent mark or inking. So it was used for people like Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Van Gogh, all used gall ink for creating some of their masterpieces. The U.S. Treasury used it. The Declaration of Independence and the Magna Carta were written in permanent
wow.
ink derived from galls.
Wow, that is so amazing. How come we don't know that? I mean, that's just crazy that we shouldn't know that.
It does seem like a fun fact that kind of has been overlooked by a lot of things, such as the case with insects. They often get a bad rap for things they do, and a lot of the benefits that we derive from insects are generally overlooked. So it's one of the things that's really nice about getting a chance today to kind of give credit where it's due a bit.
Yeah, well, that is so cool. And as so often happens when we're out in the field, time has escaped us again for today, so please join us next month when we continue our search for insects and their galls. But first, let's hear our mystery sound again. And that sound is the sound of a grasshopper. A contrast of the two sounds that they most commonly make. The first, the sound of their back legs rubbing, and the second, the sound of their wings snapping. Would you like to tell us a bit more about those sounds, Richard?
Yeah, grasshoppers are amazing in that they do make a lot of noise. Some insects really don't have any kind of noise-making devices, but grasshoppers use their hind legs, which have a bunch of little bumps or ridges on them, and they rub it rapidly against their wing cover. It's called stridulation, and that's how they make a call or a courtship call.
When I was reading a little bit about it, they were describing it like a bow, like a musician plays their cello with the bow, which makes perfect sense.
Yeah, they actually, with all the technology today on the internet, if you look up stridulation, you'll see some really cool video of how their legs are rubbing against the wing covers, and it is a lot like a bow on a violin. The other sound that they make is during flight, and they snap their wings out, and it creates kind of a popping or a snapping sound. And this is kind of has a dual purpose. It does also attract other grasshoppers around, and they use it to kind of impress the females before they start stridulating to try and court them in. But it's also a defense mechanism. It's kind of this loud cracking noise, and if they feel threatened or if there's predators in the area, sometimes they'll pop like that to try and drive off something that they're not comfortable with.
Huh, that's cool. And listening to those online too, some of them can be really loud. Will a grasshopper do both types of calls? Will every species do different types of calls?
There are different calls for different species, but it's generally the adult male that's making the noises. So they need the wing cover in order to make the noise, and only the adult form has wings. So juvenile grasshoppers aren't able to make the stridulation that the adults are able to do. And as a call for courtship or trying to pull in the females, it's typically only the males that are making that type of a noise.
Well, very interesting. That is it for Nature Now for the second week of October. Thanks so much to Richard for being our guide to the amazing world of insects, and to Meg Amos for being our field recorder. Thanks also to Nora Petrich for being our sound editor, and to all of you for listening. We'll look forward to hearing part two of this fascinating talk next month. Closing music this week will be Grasshopper by the Mamas and the Papas. As always, wishing you happy trails.
Dungeness River Nature Center is pleased to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature, Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.